My presentation is on the decision-making in older dialysis patients, and I want to move right into it because I want to present two aspects of this. One is how dialysis and dialysis patients might be conceived of as an interesting and important laboratory for understanding end-of-life decision-making, and then some comments as part of also the methodological observations about the difficulties of doing such research. And then lastly, we'll present a few of our findings. It's end-stage renal disease is a common condition in this country, and it's important because it represents an entitlement. Now, that has, in some ways, very, very good aspects because it means the patients have ready access to a life-saving or life-prolonging procedure. But it has a lot of mischief built into it, meaning that the threshold for putting somebody on or keeping somebody on dialysis has fallen. And to the point now that we have many people on dialysis who can only benefit marginally from the procedure, and it costs over $200,000 per patient per year. And so it becomes an ethical issue of a different sort, one that we have not come to grips with very well as a society, but which in a sense is a wonderful area for us to focus on because the decision-making, the values, the goals, the benefits all need to be teased out more accurately. Now, there's a 23% annual mortality, as I have on the slide, from elderly people on dialysis. And that means, actually, that number covers everybody on dialysis, but the mortality is concentrated in the elderly. And that means that your chances of dying in any given year when you're on dialysis are higher than your chances of dying if you have breast cancer or even ovarian cancer. So it's a condition in which there's a very high mortality. There's a rising mortality, a number of deaths from end-stage renal disease, and there's several reasons for this rising so dramatically, largely because of the growth of the end-stage renal disease population. But more importantly, perhaps, or at least another important factor, is that increasingly people are put on dialysis because of diabetes. Diabetes is, of course, epidemic, and diabetes is a condition that, of course, progresses even after you're on dialysis. So the point is, the underlying condition that made you eligible for dialysis progresses even after you're on dialysis. So you end up with the same visual problems, microvascular problems, cardiac problems, cognitive problems, a host of other issues. Also, the age of the people entering into dialysis is steadily rising, so you end up with an older population in which the underlying rate of mortality is higher. As I say there, people are older, but they're also sicker, and this is largely represents a shift. People think of dialysis largely as life-saving, and we have sort of a cultural memory of people having difficulty getting onto dialysis. Today, the problem is almost the opposite, meaning the threshold has gotten low enough that people who are quite ill and who for whom the added benefit of being dialysis is harder to identify are encouraged enter into dialysis. There's some interesting literature, which I won't be able to touch on very much today, but it touches upon the idea that for many of our procedures that we do that are major procedures, stents, for example, or other entering into dialysis, that the decision-making point is very hard to identify. In other words, we have protocol-driven care, we have standard of high-quality care that we promulgate. So somebody turns up in the emergency room, they've had a heart attack or they've had a stroke, the care that unfolds is actually going to unfold pretty much according to protocol in most cases. It would be a rare individual who would say, stop, I want to consider this. So when we talk about the decision to go on dialysis, many of the people we interviewed said, by the time that a decision was asked for, I was on dialysis. It was either that they'd gone through an acute crisis or they'd actually even had cognitive impairment. Now, nationally, 24% of deaths of dialysis patients are preceded by termination of dialysis. Now, that's a carefully worded statement. That doesn't mean that 24% of dialysis patients decide to stop dialysis. But the dialysis is stopped on their behalf in many cases, or they stop it themselves. But the important thing is that as people get older, more have higher and higher burdens of comorbidity. And then especially when they develop advanced cognitive problems, either after stroke or advancing Alzheimer's disease, their advanced directive or their families or their care providers we'll begin to discuss the possibility of terminating the dialysis. And that's the situation under which dialysis is terminated most frequently. Just to look at the age issue a little bit, these are a little bit misleading because these are only people who are 65 or older at the time they started dialysis. In other words, I didn't want to mix the data in this particular slide with the young people on dialysis. But if you look at the population of people who are 65 or older when they start dialysis, you can see that over time, the age of death for all patients is rising. In other words, we have an aging population. And the tall bars in each case are the people that terminated dialysis. So the people that are terminating dialysis are distinguished somewhat from the rest of the dialysis population by being several years older. Another way of thinking about it is the oldest person who's being put on dialysis is probably at the highest risk of finding the burden of the therapy not adequate compensation for the benefits. This is another way of presenting the changing picture of who terminates dialysis. This is looking at by race. I apologize for the graphic here because it implies that these are additive, but they're not. They're separate curves. And what you should see here is that whereas the rate of discontinuation of dialysis is lowest in African-American populations, it is rising in all populations slowly over time. So you see a slight increase in all of the populations over time. Looking at the different age groups, again, these are not additive. They're supposed to be just single lines. The oldest populations have the highest rates of discontinuing dialysis, but it's rising slowly over time in all populations. Now, so we know that dialysis cessation is associated with a number of these factors, greater age, white race, higher comorbidity. However, when they try to develop predictive models, we have very, very little luck finding which patient is going to discontinue dialysis and which one is not. And it's been called an existential issue and certainly a highly individualized issue. And this, for those of you who do research planning, this invites then qualitative research because what you really want to do is go out and ask people. When you don't know, you should ask. And also, you're going to hear things you didn't expect if you do qualitative research. And when you're doing quantitative research, you have to know exactly what you're asking and how you're going to measure the answer. But when you're doing qualitative research, you can enter did I do that wrong? When you do qualitative research, you are able to ask a broad question and get the patient to essentially provide the answer. So we did the study in the upper Midwest. We had three investigators, one from sociology, one from nursing, and myself. Our particular area was rich for this. It's a little bit hard to see, but if you look at our hospital system is on the left here, and our rate of termination was 53%. We had several years presented there, but you can see it's higher than the national average. So we actually represented in the upper Midwest a superb area to look at this because about half of our patients were being withdrawn from dialysis or withdrawing from dialysis prior to death. Okay, we interviewed, there are 27 index dialysis patients. Several of them were too sick to interview, and so we interviewed family members. In some cases, we interviewed both family members and dialysis patients. Their mean age was 80, and they were all white. Findings were broadly some interesting things about quality of life and their adjustment to quality of life on dialysis. A lot of observations about dependency. Some interesting observations, which we will focus on for my whole minute that I'll have to discuss it, on end-of-life issues and then on discontinuation. Quality of life, rather than read these, what I'll just say is that broadly, the investigators were extremely impressed by what a contraction of horizons occurs when people are on dialysis, particularly these elderly patients. These patients were all finding that they're weak. Not only their week, but their day, not only their day, but their hour was all dictated by their dialysis. And that their travel, their social relationships, their hobbies, their work, everything was contracted. It is not just the time they spend on the dialysis machine, it's the fatigue that precedes and follows the dialysis and their sense of being connected to the machine, not literally all week long, but certainly figuratively. On the other, the counter side of that same coin, you're reaching for the sign, I can tell. Okay, is that these people evidenced an absolutely astounding adjustment. The group that we interviewed was taking it as their job. They were describing it very much as, this is what I do now. And they also had a very sort of almost 12-step kind of approach. You know, one day at a time, you know, don't sweat the small details. They had a lot of little aphorisms that they used to describe this. Now, the population we were interviewing were selected by just inviting all the dialysis patients that met our criteria to send back a postcard if they were interested in hearing more about the study. So it was definitely people that were, they were chronic dialysis patients, they were elderly, and they were willing to be interviewed. Not only that, they were willing to have somebody come to their home. So there was a variety of things that sort of self-selected into the population that was fairly well-adjusted. The dependency issues came up a great deal. First of all, the degree of dependency was not difficult to detect. It was really in our face all the time. People were describing their ambivalence about having their children and their other family members do as much for them as they did. In other words, they all found that they had a great deal of need for essentially everything. They had all the transportation needs, of course, back and forth to dialysis if they were doing the 3-time-a-week hemo. We were interviewing both hemo and peritoneal dialysis. But they also had dependency for everything else because their physical stamina and their physical agility, getting up on a chair, for example, is all diminished in this population. They're very grateful for the help that they got, but what I mean by ambivalence is that this was people that, in general, like most of us, don't want to be dependent. And generally, this was dependency that had come on them rather unexpectedly, because the transition from being a chronic renal failure patient who is not on dialysis to being a chronic renal failure patient who is on dialysis means a transition from being fairly independent, though not well, to a situation in which you're really tied to the machine and tied to a schedule that holds you down. Conversely, on the bottom there, you can see the family member's statement. When we interviewed family members, their enthusiasm for providing the care was essentially undiluted. We didn't run into any families that were grousing about it or saying, boy, it'll be a relief when I don't have to do this anymore. People were either not expressing that, we're strangers, we're coming into their homes. They're not going to express that necessarily, but they were, even in the choice of words, you could tell, going back to the literature, you could tell that by their choice of words, they were not, that wasn't weighing on them particularly. Many people and many of the family members felt it was something of a privilege or an honor. At least that's the way they talked about it, to be able to provide this service for their elderly family members. People didn't want to become a burden, and actually that's where they drew the line when we asked them, at what point would you not want to continue? Now, I actually, in my notes, I told myself to pause before I put this slide up, because I want to introduce this properly. The most unexpected finding from our interviews was the inability of this population to talk about end of life. I eventually called Dr. Lewis Cohen, who's a psychiatrist in Bayfield, Mass., who is the leading national expert on dialysis cessation, and I went over this with him. I said, you know, we interviewed all these people, and we couldn't get them to talk about end of life. And I violated every principle of good interview technique that you can do. Well, you're supposed to ask good open-ended questions, tell me about so-and-so, or describe such-and-such. I mean, I know how to do the interviewing, but I wasn't getting any answers, so I'd go to the next layer and the next layer. And finally, I got to, you know, when you go to dialysis, you must see a lot of people who are a lot sicker than you are, you know, people with amputations and blind and everything else like that. Do you ever think that there might be a time when you might want to actually say enough is enough? No. And that's not good interview technique, nor was it a satisfactory answer. Now, I've got up here a couple of the quotes, and this was the kind of language we got. Now, among the 31 interviews, of course, we did have some descriptions of what people intended to do when their end-of-life decision-making got difficult, but mostly it was this kind of thing that was rather vague and unfocused. Here are a couple of Q&As about advanced directives. What does it say? I can't remember. What are your instructions? I've forgotten. What is your instruction to go and try and head and keep me alive? By the way, the last comment I have on the bottom there, I did not want to be a vegetable. I would put in exactly the same category. Who does want to be a vegetable? Show of hands. I mean, you know, it's not actually a helpful comment. It's not a penetrating observation about what the person wants at the end of their life. And we heard that a lot. I don't want to be a vegetable. So we were puzzling and actually, what our analysis will conclude with when we write this for publication will be an in-depth analysis of what it is that is character, how this population may differ from other elderly populations. And there's a, one big thing I'd like to perhaps leave with you as a thought, and that's this is a population of people who have already made the transition to being dependent. They have accepted to a very large degree the dependency on the machine and to some degree the social dependency that comes with that. So younger people and people who are healthy generally live by the aphorism, again, I'm citing some literature here, give me health or give me death. Thank you, Patrick Henry. They don't want to tolerate a lot. They can't imagine themselves tolerating a lot of disability. Once you have the disability, once you have the presbyopia or the baldness or the bad ankle or the, you know, the, you name it, you become very tolerant of it. And these people were actually an extreme case of learning to live with disability, and therefore they'd already adjusted to a new norm in some ways. People that are lifetime users of wheelchairs adjust to a new norm in many cases, and their baseline has moved to a new place. And the person that's not in the wheelchair can't understand it, but the person in the wheelchair has a whole range that starts from that starting point, and that's much what we think we saw in our patients. And that is my time. We will publish shortly. I don't even have a cartoon at the end, except for the universal conclusion of all research, which is that more research is needed. Okay, thank you. Interestingly, we did, but it's not in the direction that you might imagine. People were universally in awe and grateful for the end-stage renal disease program. It was lauded as being something, well, I don't have to worry about that. They would say they had financial burden because they paid people to transport them, or because they couldn't get to sales. They had to buy the things off, you know, whatever was the most convenient. And so their transportation issues led to financial problems. But the treatment itself did not. And so the end-stage renal disease patients were very, and many of them were quite clear about that was a privilege to be able to have that kind of care without having to be a financial burden.